This is the Climb to Space.
Hello and welcome to the Decline to State Internet Radio Stream, the show in which we get together to discuss the ups and downs of life outside the Matrix. Decline to State is proud to bring you one of the surprisingly few netcasts in which the hosts do not support acts of aggression against you. You can find us on the web at declinefm.com, where you'll find a link to the live chat. The live chat is your go-to way to interact with other listeners or bring up points for discussion on the show. Today marks a title shift here at Decline to State. We are about to launch DTS 2.0 online. But more on that later. I'm Ronald McPaul, your beacon of freedom in the heart of the Silicon Valley. I'm joined by my handsome co-casters, and I'll let them go around the horn and introduce themselves.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Eternal.
This is Toast.
Wrong opinion here, coming to you from the Rust Belt, as always.
Sounds good. Eternal, you had an interesting topic.
I'll introduce it just after making a quick announcement to anybody who is listening that our website has, the design process has been finished, and it looks pretty dang good, and we're doing some actual putting it together thematic work right now, but it's almost there, but the launch may not be for another month or so, so we're trying to pack it in with some other goodies.
But it is worth mentioning that we did hire a voluntarist professional, and we did put money into it too, and maybe sometime in the future we'll even get a Bitcoin donation page or something to help, if people want to help make the show possible, make it spread and get it all over the place like AIDS.
Yeah, well, maybe not quite as bad as that, but
I agreed to that way too fast. I should have listened to what you said first.
It'll be hard to get rid of, though.
Well, that's the point.
Well, I don't know. They're working on a cure for AIDS, but you know what they're really not working on a cure for?
Herpes. Decline to State? Oh yeah.
So like, it's more like herpes. It's not going to kill you, but it's just going to flare every now and then.
Those feels.
But in any case, yeah, for any of the listeners, you know, when we do unveil the stuff, hopefully you'll be able to see the quality that actually throwing money at a problem creates, and maybe we'll, if the feedback's good on that and you want to see more of that stuff, we'll throw up a Bitcoin donation page. That would be nice.
And, you know, ultimately, I think it's really good to keep all that money in the community. Like, if you need a website built, there are tons of website builders that are voluntarists. I just think it's really cool to keep that circulating within. You'd even pay in Bitcoin, and that would be really cool too.
Yeah, it was great.
I think it would be great. We get it so big that, like, if you have to get a website made, well, like, half the web designers take only Bitcoin, because that's just how they roll.
And that's people's problem with Bitcoin. And they always say, like, oh, well, what am I going to buy that isn't guns? Well, web design.
Drugs.
That's a good point, Ron. We also want drugs with our guns.
Drugs are not guns.
Eternal, he doesn't want to keep himself secret. We're allowed to kind of promote who our designer is, right? We should probably...
Oh, yeah, we can definitely do that. I would just figure we'd talk about him more when we unveiled the actual launch page.
Oh, I gotcha. Yeah.
Yeah. So he can be our secret Santa for now, just because, I don't think he would mind us talking about him at all. I think he'd prefer it. I think he told me to spread the word.
So spread the good word. And now that we've gotten rid of our PG audience by some offhand, somewhat offensive remarks, we did have a topic for today. This was one of our casts where we had the kind of the most changes of gear in the preceding 24 hours that I think we've had. We potentially have two different guests, maybe one or two or three different topics. We've been going back and forth a lot, but here we are together again on the radio.
Yeah, it's good to be back. I guess we didn't have a cast last week. So to start off today, I wanted to talk about something that's, I feel like it's the elephant in the room in terms of the general ANCAP, liberty, anarchist community. And it's something that's been nagging at, butting at my heel for a while, which is the overuse of the moral argument, which I think is especially because of our good friend Stefan Molyneux being, you know, the guy he is. And
controversial.
And really, yeah. But, well, being very loud in his... I can't remember how to pronounce that word.
Proselytization.
Yeah, that's the word. Yeah.
It's a mouthful.
I could see why you had trouble
Prozac.
With it.
You gonna be all right?
I don't think I'm gonna be okay. I haven't even drank my scotch yet, so we'll see how...
That's your problem right there.
Yeah. So what makes you think it's an elephant in the room?
I think it's something that a lot of us who don't over-rely on that argument. We don't really try to promote the conflict in the community by going after people who do. I think that it's more of, there's a lot of people out there who are throwing more arguments around, like, you know, handing them out like candy, and often in the wrong place, the wrong time, for the wrong reasons, or just on shaky ground in general. And I think there's not enough of the counter argument, which is slow down, let's take a different approach to this, and maybe either, we'll talk about this today, you know, maybe for various reasons you should not use that argument here.
Huh, okay. Well, I mean, for example, what you're doing is sort of comparing, I guess you might call it consequentialist or even possibly nihilist approaches to the very popular deontological or natural rights approach to arguing. And so if it is indeed an elephant in the room, and I actually don't see it discussed all that often, although it's something that matters to me, one argument could be more effective with a person than it would be with compared to another person, right?
I think to sum it up, I think the moral arguments are over-relied upon. I think that it's easy to tailor arguments to the person you're talking to, and we are underutilizing other means of communicating our ideas to other people. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I want to make sure I understand better, maybe I'll kind of repeat it out loud and you guys can see if I grasp it right, is and this might just be for you, Eternal, but you know, view the debate, maybe even the debate within the volunteers, within the ANCAP community, the actual act of argumentation, to be a very important part of, you know, what we do in the quote-unquote movement. Like the way those things are framed, how that spills out over into other, you know, outside the community, engaging other people in it, because, you know, that's part of how it spreads, right? You say, you know, you achieve whether something is right or wrong by, you know, using your words and you know, making something that could be objectifiably false at different points. And so because that's important, the way that it's approached is worth talking about, because what seems to be, and I guess, you know, now that you guys mention it, kind of strikes me too as being, is, you know, kind of over the top, is that people will say things are objectively true. Like you can start from a couple a priori rules or a couple ideas, deontological ethics, to kind of explain what that is, because I had to look it up this week when I was preparing for our discussion. So if somebody else did, you're not alone. It's considered a normative ethical position. I had to look up that too. But it's a position that judges morality on an action based on the action's adherence to a set of rules. And normative, I guess, you know, Toast, maybe you can verify this, but it's like a positive statement or something. But
shalt do.
Yeah.
Or so I guess that's shalt not do. Yeah, I think that's right.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. So I guess that's what we're talking about today. You know, the assumption that these arguments are important, and potentially that these things get thrown around too much, or, you know, potentially, you know, we'll come to a conclusion, but, you know, because words are important, the arguments you use are important, and, you know, is it fair, or does it make you look bad to say, hey, this and that?
There's a further complicating factor, I think. And that's that people sort of associate their trip from mainstream political to libertarian or ANCAP or whatever. They perceive that as a very good thing. And I mean, I agree with that. Like, it was a great personal experience for me. I have a deeper life, a deeper understanding of relationships because of that. Great. So if you're a person that came there through a moral argument, you're going to value that particular moral argument extremely highly. And I mean, you just see that all over the Reddit sphere, right? People feel very, very strongly that the moral approach is the right way because that was their approach. Same thing happens with consequentialists, of course, that if you were convinced maybe by one of the popular consequentialists, David Friedman, for example, you might feel very strongly that, in fact, the consequentialist approach is the right way to convince people because you were convinced that way.
I see what you're saying. And so that does
people
make
have
sense,
a lot of yeah. emotional attachment to these.
They become very invested in their own path. And that seems to be, you know, obviously not just within the Reddit spheres or debating, you know, philosophy or economics and, you know, whatever stuff we like to talk about. People become very invested in the way they learn things. And it's a positive thing, too, that people want to help others to learn, you know, what they've embraced or to find the good that they have. I mean, that's a positive thing at its core, to try to share what, you know, your joys in life. But maybe to an extent that can bias people towards thinking that it has to be that way. You know, they're too tied to it, too fixed to it, which is what we're talking about here.
I agree with that. And I think it's the most important thing that I really want to hit on as the core topic here is that when we go and we talk to people who are not familiar with, you know, ANCAPism, the various theories of polycentric law or, you know, deep NAP philosophy or any of that stuff, we have to take into account the values they bring to the table as a person. Because, you know, obviously not everybody came to where we are today from the same place. Not all of us shared the same values coming in. And different arguments probably had different impacts for each of us. Maybe even, you know, the four of us in the room today were swayed by different things in different amounts. So what we have to do when we communicate with new people is identify their values and tailor the arguments that not the things that would appear the things that would appeal to us, but tailor them to the things that would appeal to them.
So, yeah, which is yeah. it takes more work to do what you just said than I thought it would.
Oh, it's hard. It's very, yeah. very hard. And what we have to do as ANCAPs in general, as philosophers, because we are philosophers, that's pretty much what we do on a daily basis, is talk about ideas, talk about philosophy.
Do I get a merit badge for that or something?
Oh, yeah, you should. 5 merit badges.
Hell yeah.
Yeah, you can stick them all around like Flair.
Participation trophies and everything? Yeah, let's do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you get the Rothbard head on the trophy.
Achievement unlocked.
You know, the Nazis had pieces of flair they made the Jews wear. Just saying.
Godwin's Law.
Well, that's it. That's the end of the podcast, everyone.
Ron ruined it again.
Yep.
God, sorry, Eternal. You did have a train of thought, though. Wrong is right. I'm derailing too much.
But if I can pick up, it's right. Everyone has different goals. Like, if you hear the common criticisms, it's always like, okay, well, this isn't going to work. Okay, well, work in our language means that it achieves goals or whatever. And it does mean the first step of an argument has to be, like, even if you're going to choose, like, a deontological approach, you have to ask a person, well, what do you expect to get out of government and really those people around you? What are your expectations? And then follow that with, like, how do we produce that?
That kind of reminds me of what I picked up when I started dabbling in nonviolent communication. It's very focused on what people's needs are, because everyone has needs they want met. And when somebody says the infamous expression, "Who will build the roads?" they're not trying to say, "I think statism is good." They have a serious and legitimate concern over transportation, and, you know, you just haven't convinced them yet that
Obama will do it.
Well, not including Obama, you haven't convinced them yet that the solution you propose addresses that need of theirs. So it's very important to help people see how their needs are not being addressed or are not being addressed sufficiently at this time via government, which I can almost 100% guarantee they never really are, and they just haven't realized it because they haven't critically thought about it that much.
I think a lot of people, to build on that, I think a lot of people have goals that they kind of cast aside and put aside as unrealistic or ideas that they think are not legitimate because they don't fit into the current paradigm of the way society works. And what we really need to do is allow people to start accessing those hidden ideas of how things may work. This is a big hurdle to do with a lot of people, but to get them to think quote unquote outside the box, you know, to get them to explore the what ifs without all these attachments of you know, government rules and regulations and the current societal framework of how things are done. It's very difficult for somebody to see how things might be done if they aren't already done that way. A lot of people are just, they're not visualizers of new ideas. They can't think in the abstract. And a lot of that is from, you know, being in public school, and maybe their personalities aren't really wired for that kind of thinking. I don't know. But it's very hard. And we need to encourage that more and be really try to get them to come up with more ideas on their own. This is my personal approach that I want to use more often, which is you really get them to help brainstorm ideas, have them kind of reason through things, and be more of a facilitator rather than an explainer. Because when they can come up with one idea and they think that they're the originator of it, and sometimes I do hear new ideas out of people this way, but you know, when they're an originator of an idea, they'll be more attached to it. They'll be more inclined to be comfortable with other people coming up with their ideas and them coming up with more ideas in the future. So I think being a facilitator rather than an instructor or schooler, as you would say, is a good thing. And we need to work at that.
All right. Well, I mean, if you take that message, do we want to apply that differently to a consequentialist than to a deontological person, morally inclined person?
Well, definitely. And actually, I think we do a good job of that on the moral side. I think we do a very good job with, there's some things like George Ought to Help is a good video. If any of you haven't seen that in the audience, go check it out. Just Google it.
Extremely compelling.
Things like that, which just go step by step and have very clear explanations of, if we assume this simple axiom of, you know, don't hit, don't steal, when you follow the steps and connect the dots, you really do reach the conclusion that, you know, state using force to enforce some set of values on other people is wrong.
And what's so great about it is that anybody can understand it in the way that you just described, Eternal. It's the consequentialist route. You know, while geniuses like, you know, Aniran and Stephen Kinsella can debate about it like they recently did on that thread after he was kind enough to be on our show, you know, they can get the bigger ideas. But for the average person you talk to who isn't well-versed in economics and things that aren't intuitively obvious to most people, being able to show them something like George Ought to Help or a video that just says, you know, this is the NAP by Stephen, by Stefan Molyneux, stuff like that. It seems sometimes to me, at least when I'm trying to explain things to people, if I feel inclined to, that it's more relatable, it's more easily grasped. You know, it's something that we all learn as kids. But
it is simpler. I definitely think that's the utility of the approach, which is that it's simple to get and complicated to extrapolate.
And expand on that a little bit, actually.
Well, I mean, the principles are very simple, but they lead to. So this is a bit of a segue, but I think this will explain what I'm saying very well. So I don't know if you've noticed this, but there's a trend. You see this on the ANCAP boards very frequently. I haven't seen anything in a little while, but it used to be like every week there'd be a new thread. How does X and X scenario play out with regards to the NAP? You know, how is doing this a violation of the NAP? ANCAPs, how do you square your thoughts on this with the NAP? All of this relating back to, if you have some weird circumstances, sometimes these simple rules don't make a lot of sense anymore. And, you know, that there's lots of ways of dealing with it. A lot of these things are kind of contrived scenarios, hypotheticals. But what happens is when we really are dismissive about those things and we don't have good answers, how does that reflect in terms of the values of the people bringing them up and the values we're expanding? Is that the right word?
Yeah. I mean, to be, if I would put it in my own words, to verify, I understand, to be rigorous about it, if you find a, you know, even if it's somewhat ridiculous, if you find a fail point for it or find a place where it can no longer apply, you are kind of lacking a little bit of integrity, or at least not being fully honest with yourself if you're saying that, yes, the NAP is concrete and perfect and impenetrable. And it's just, I can type those three letters into a Reddit comment and I will win and be right. And I will blast victorious freedom all over the status I'm talking to. It doesn't quite work that way anymore. If you look at those fringe conditions and say, hey, maybe there's a hole in it. Maybe it's not perfect.
Well, I mean, it's easy to start dismissing an argument because you disagree with one of the premises. Like, I've had a lot of experiences where I'm reading like an economic piece, person declares all of their givens or their assumptions right at the start, and then I disagree with one of the assumptions, and I detach from the entire argument, don't take any of it seriously, even if I probably don't read it carefully, because I think, well, this person's just taking a stupid assumption. The NAP might be that way. Maybe somebody takes just a different definition of aggression. Well, then they think, well, every single time that a libertarian uses the word aggression, I just disagree with that. Because my definition's different.
That's a very good point, which is, of course, that the non-aggression principle makes sense when you take very clear-cut and identifiable ideas of aggression, like murder. I mean, that's pretty straightforward. Or rape, that's pretty straightforward. But, you know, maybe some loose pollution that drifts over, you know, an entire state. How does that really work?
Or right, the sum of immeasurable amounts of pollution.
Or even somebody just like leaving their windows open in their house and walking around like buck naked with a, I don't even want to go further than that, but.
Well, yeah, I don't, it's not constructive to really get into the specifics, because I think the point is that people can have different definitions. Like, yeah. Oh, the other example I was just thinking of to contradict myself entirely there is like, you know, to at what point does loud music in a house constitute aggression against your neighbor? Or I don't know. That's going to be something that law has to decide. Not even has to, but like just will decide. Does now, would in ANCAP land. But I don't know what extent makes it moral or not. They're just, right. You know, they're difficult cases.
Well, when you talk about a moral theory, and a quote-unquote objective moral theory, like, you know, the deontological non-aggression principle, and you run up against things where the correct answer is the market will decide, which is to say, there'll be some sort of cost-benefit exchange as to what the line is in the sand. Then people look at that as being, I think a lot of people look at that as being intellectually dishonest in a way, which is to say, they see you claiming these universals on one hand, and then saying something which is just kind of tossing it to the wind, we don't really have an answer, on another hand.
Well, it's characteristically similar. Yeah, it's characteristically similar to what psychoanalysts, I think, call like the big other. That a lot of libertarians or market anarchists, whatever, are going to say that, like, okay, well, the market is going to take care of something. And while there's actually some pretty good science to go back that up, not science, like logic to back that up, it kind of sounds like it's just an appeal to this force.
Mm-hmm. I agree with that. What was the psychoanalytical term you brought up? That's
like the big other. I don't even know if that's correct.
Okay.
So I've heard Molyneux say things like people use the state as their big other. It's just this force and law will just, you know, it'll take care of it.
Oh, I understand what you're describing now. So I've observed the same thing, if I understand you correctly, that the big, you know, that big other term, you explain it well, sometimes, or in a way I can understand, that will be, I guess, you know, God or something, or sometimes a state.
Oh, yeah.
And sometimes you hear people that, you know, I have the same kind of position that they do, but I see them talking about the market as the big other. Like, you could just as easily replace it with the state or Obama or, you know, Super Jeebus or whoever it is. And it would otherwise be the same in text. And I'm just like, I cringe when I see that. I'm like, you're strawmanning yourself, or that's not going to end up good.
The market gave me a phone. It's going to do more.
the thing is, like, even if it's correct on an economic level, the statement itself is an appeal to values that you may have, because we value things like free exchange, voluntary mutual exchange of goods, and the market being freed up as much as possible. We're already aligned with those values. That's what we think. But for somebody who doesn't value those things already, you're making an appeal to values they don't have. So unless they're working in that direction, like they're already pro free markets in most areas and don't quite understand how it could work in others, like, as I was saying before, you have to tailor the arguments to the values of the person you're talking to. And for most people, just appealing to the market will take care of it is not a good way to appeal to their values.
I like that. But you are pointing out too, that's interesting, that there is a place. There are those people who are kind of just on the brink, or where you're almost preaching to the choir. You're like preaching to the first few rows in the church, and those people you're gonna help, you know, quote unquote, get there. But otherwise,
To expand, I really want to make a good point, which I think there is this breaking point that occurs, because I feel like it happened with me too. especially in the realms of national defense, you know, that would be the breaking point for a lot of minarchists, which is once you can get past one hard problem and decide that, oh wait, the market can actually solve this, it's not too hard to extend that to other problems and say, hey, you know, the market works for this problem that I previously thought it wouldn't solve, so yeah, I understand that it probably could work for these other things too, and that there's some economics behind it that I don't maybe understand quite yet, but I have a reasonable faith that it probably works. And there's that tipping point where you just get to the point where you're like, I know the market's going to take care of it. I don't know exactly how, but I'll leave it up to the experts in the field that want to go and make money on that. But it's going to happen.
The market's going to do it live.
Pretty much.
On the subject of the big other, I couldn't help but imagine the analogy in my own mind of someone trying to explain the Tao to a fundamentalist Christian. It's something that's so outside of their paradigm that whenever you say to a fundamentalist Christian the Tao that can be explained is not the real Tao, they'll just laugh at you and say you're crazy and tell you to go away. And in a very similar vein, when you come up to a statist and you say, you know, I like to say there's no central plan for how a free market will work, because the statist wants one way to solve a problem that has multiple variables. Not all of them can be accounted for by one person or a small group of people, and there is no one answer to the problem presented in the first place. So when you're talking to someone who's thinking centrally, I think it's very important to help them understand there's no central plan for how a free market solves problems, because a market isn't one person or one group of people deciding in every single case how some mechanism is going to work. The market is just a word that we use to describe the sum of all human actions on the face of the earth. It, you know, voluntary, it's not really actions. Right, voluntary actions, of course.
Yes. Yes, wrong. And well put. And I think I'll spell it out too, because I think both you and Eternal were kind of saying it too. Eternal said that, you know, he was admitting that I don't know the answers, which is, you know, a hard thing for people to do. And a lot of times you find the people that know the most or know a lot are going to be the most willing to say, you know, or to admit, I don't know. But, you know, on top of that, it's quite scary. I mean, part of the reason it's hard to make that jump is, let's be honest, to say that I have no answer, or there is no answer, or the answer is in transactions of millions of people, or it's in the quote-unquote market, that is a scary thought, because you just, it's like, you know, to some people it's like throwing up your hands and it's just like saying, market all the things. It's like, I don't know. I just, it'll happen, I guess. I mean, I think if you want to spread the message, that's, you kind of have to, I guess, realize that you're doing that to the person that you're talking to. You're making that fear well up in them, this like, that, you know, that feeling of uncertainty. You've all felt it before. Like, what is going to take the place of this Obama that I know now?
And by the way, it doesn't actually undermine any of the arguments here, but I couldn't find anything on the internet about something called a big other. I swear there's another word for it, but it's not that.
We should
still, the concept is pretty valid. I mean,
yeah, no, I mean, you've explained to us. We should just name the title. We should title this podcast The Big Other.
Be a good name for the cast.
I think we should just say that you coined the term then.
Yeah.
I'll be like a revolutionary.
Yeah, I knew
intellectual property on it.
I knew what you were talking about, though, when I heard the words big other. I think it's very descriptive. It's the God, it's the God machine, I guess you could say. What, you know, whatever applied phlebotonym you want to throw in there, that's what the big other is.
Yeah. I heard it once referred to as I'm getting a little technical, but in code writing, you know, the blob class, that we'll just throw it in the class that does everything and not worry about it. Blob object, is that
no, it's just, I remember back in Java class, like the highest level of the object trees was just called like object. Yeah, whatever.
The object. Oh man, I don't want to get into the abstractions of coding languages.
Too meta for you.
Yeah, too meta.
Well, now that we've derailed the conversation.
I do want to bring this back though, to what we were saying before about the NAP, which is the NAP can be the big other for many ANCAPs, which they is can. To say, you know, we just appeal to non-aggression, we appeal to the moral reasoning, and leave it as that, without thinking about the complexities of the values people hold and the complexities of human interaction. And so you end up with a lot of rather awkward conclusions. And I think Walter Block, I love the guy to death, but he comes up with some conclusions which actually, to me, illustrate why the moral reasoning approach sometimes isn't very good, which is you get like the guy in a flagpole, for instance. So I think we've all heard this here. You know, you have a guy there's a guy who falls off a skyscraper and he gets caught in a flagpole on the way down outside somebody's window. And the person who owns, you know, the window in the building and then that flagpole, should they be allowed to deny that guy entry through the window? Basically, you know, is the guy who's caught in the flagpole, can he climb in through the window even though he doesn't own that property and hasn't asked permission?
I think you can even take it one step further.
Is that aggression?
From the Block scenario here and ask the question, if the flagpole belongs to you and you consider that person trespassing on your property, are they violating the NAP by not letting go of your flagpole, or are you violating the NAP by removing them from the flagpole and sending them to their certain doom?
Correct. Yeah, that's exactly what we wanted to do, is look at that scenario right there and identify not just, you know, who's aggressing on who or whatnot, but what are all the values in play here? And what is the complexity in human interaction that is going on in this scenario, which is, of course, people don't exist in isolation. Obviously, if people see a guy get disconnected from a flagpole and fall to their death, it's going to have social repercussions for the guy who caused it. We have, you know, the idea that, well, if you're everyone wants to be rescued on the brink of death by someone else, except for people trying to commit suicide, I guess. So the idea that there's some reciprocity there. So if I let you climb back through my window, you'll probably let me, you know, do the same in the future at some point. And it's a good thing to have. It's economically beneficial to have that kind of unwritten contract out there. I'm sure there's lots of other values at play. Toasty, Ron, you guys think of any?
It seems, I mean, I get where you're coming from. It seems common sense to want to let, you know, if you kind of simplify things in your mind. I mean, we've for a little while there, we really were engaging, you know, our logical parts of our brain and talking about the assumptions and applying logic rigorously and consistently. But in a scenario like that, it's something that we all, you know, can easily picture and conceptualize and stuff like that. It's just, the answer seems obvious. It's like it's built into us, you know, for the most part, unless you're full psychopath.
As a nihilist, right, if you say psychopath, as a nihilist,
same thing, really.
When Eternal, you asked me if I could think of anything else, I had already stopped listening to you because I thought the argument was really boring. And maybe that even goes to illustrate kind of the point we're trying to make here, that because I know what I would do in that situation, that if I were in an adjacent office to the guy whose flagpole got trespassed, I would just go and the guy, you know, cut off the flagpole guy, falling guy fell to his death. I would just go and just like, you know, punch the guy in the face whose office was right next to mine because he's a jerk. I don't want to be anywhere near that guy. I don't want to associate with him at all. The moral argument's like, well, why are you going through this? I just don't want to be near that guy anyway.
Most importantly, I think, you know, what kind of person would not save a guy who just needs a little bit of help?
But which is appealing the kind of person is a moral argument.
You know, what it is it's the intrinsic morality, the moral compass that we all get built in with, for the most part, for most people get built in with. I see appeals to this in philosophy, philosophical writers across the board all the time, is the appeal to the moral compass. And what happens is if you make objective claims about ethics, you often run into situations where, well, your claims may run up against the moral compass and it might not make a lot of sense to people. And that's a point for dismissal. So what we need to do is really think about when we're making claims about, you know, what constitutes aggression here or there, I think we need to talk more about the importance of the NAP in terms of the grand scheme theme of human interaction in general, which is to say, there may be scenarios where aggression versus non-aggression just doesn't really matter a whole heck of a lot. And what's much more important is the institutions of reputation and the social reciprocity and things I was talking about before. The idea is that, you know, if we do really bad things to people, it doesn't really matter whether it's aggression or not. It matters more so how it's perceived economically.
What the societal consensus is, what voluntary people interacting, what kind of things they come to, or societal norms or culture and all that stuff, right?
And it sounds a bit moral relativistic and wishy-washy. I know it does, but the important thing is that, you know, much like the Pirate Code of Conduct, the NAP is, you know, more of a guideline.
I think something that's crucial not to forget in all of this is that the NAP isn't a law of the universe. There are some natural law types who would disagree with me when I say that, but being someone who respects and observes subjective value all around him, I have to say that the NAP itself is a social construct among many, and it is a very base social construct. But the thing is, when you come into bizarre situations like you know, lifeboat scenarios or the quit trespassing on my flagpole scenario, the escape I found from that, because I found myself in a moral trap, I couldn't square myself with being in line with the NAP and shoving that guy off of my flagpole for trespassing. I had to realize that the NAP, being just a social construct, it's a morality that only exists if enough people agree that it exists. And for that reason, when you're in something of a survival scenario, that those kinds of morality, in my opinion, just fly right out the window, and it really doesn't matter anymore at that point. And at that point, you're either thinking more, I guess, consequentially, or maybe from a utilitarian point of view. Like, if I shove this guy off of my flagpole, and Eternal mentioned this before, what ramifications come of that? You know, if I shove this guy off of my flagpole for trespassing, well, excuse me, maybe that was NAP compliant, but now everybody in the town and maybe all across the globe will know my name and fear and hate me, and no one will want to do business with me anymore. Or on the other hand, if I drag this guy into my house, despite the fact he was trespassing on my flagpole, he might reward me for saving his life, despite the fact I would have been completely within my rights to essentially, I guess, murder him for trespassing on my property.
Yeah, and that's kind of why, like, why I don't go off downvoting people on Reddit who make kind of similar arguments when they're presented with these sort of lifeboat-ish scenarios. That I think there are people out there who that are really helped very significantly by these sort of, I guess, admittedly overly simple moral codes like the NAP. It's really useful to them. And I'm a person who's kind of recklessly overconfident sometimes, and I think that I can guide my... I think that I can impact the world in such a way as to move it towards the ideal society that I would like for myself and for those around me. But there might be people out there who aren't quite as confident like that, or don't want to spend years reading literature like I did. I don't necessarily advise that to anybody. The NAP is sort of a moral code that'll get you somewhere in the right direction.
I definitely think that we need to think about moral codes in general as they're also we need to think about the manifestations of those moral codes in what we consider economic and legal systems that we create. And David Freeman talks about this, which is, of course, anarcho-capitalism. As he talks about it, it's really polycentric legal systems. It's about polycentric law.
He was fun to talk to. That guy is smart as shit.
Yeah, he makes me feel pretty dang dumb. But what he said is, just because you have multiple competing legal systems doesn't necessarily mean that those legal systems will follow the NAP. They won't necessarily have libertarian law unless people find that to be economically worthwhile. And as libertarians, what we like to say is, well, the NAP is a really good baseline for a low cost to implement, really easy to understand, a very simplistic approach to human interaction. And if it does impose unnecessary costs, it's going to be really, really rare that it actually does. On the edges, you know, these weird lifeboat scenarios where guys hang off of a flagpole. So, you know, 99.9% of the time, it's going to be a really good system to follow. Whereas, you know, obviously our status legal system today that we follow is really, really bad and imposes tons and tons of costs, and we can demonstrate them all over the place. It doesn't take any effort whatsoever to show how inefficient it is. And of course, you know, as Austrians, we know that any sort of central planning, any sort of monopolistic approach is going to have those inefficiencies. So what's going to happen when we go to a polycentric legal system? We'll just get to see what ideas, what moral codes are the most efficient in the marketplace. Let them compete. That clarifies it for you guys.
Seems like an answer that can more universally apply. It's stepping, it's wading into the unknown a little bit, I guess. If I'm going to sum up kind of what I learned about or what I understand now after talking about the consequentialist type side and the moral approach, is that the consequentialist might be a little bit more complicated, might seem a little bit more uncertain. But, you know, like, you know, and having David Friedman on the show helps a lot. It, you know, it can work, I guess.
I wouldn't be so quick as to call the natural rights side less complicated. Because I have some good counterexamples of that.
That's actually a good point, actually. I spent a lot of this time this week reading about those arguments.
I'm saying that the NAP, the non-aggression principle, is generally pretty straight. It's one principle. It's straightforward. It's the grand universal theory of morality, you know, like the equivalent of the universal theory of physics that they're always looking for. It's elegant in its simplicity, even though it may not have necessarily a lot of depth as to, you know, what is aggression, this and that. I think the sentiment, the idea behind it is very simple. It's one value to keep track of, and you don't have conflicting values to worry about, and that can be very simple for people to make their everyday decisions based on that. You know, something as simple as spanking is an extraordinarily complicated topic when it comes to, you know, debating regular people. I mean, 90% of people still spank their kids or something. But if you look at it from a non-aggression point of view, it's 100% just you can't do it. And of course, empirically, we can go and do these studies, and there are a huge amount of evidence out there that it's detrimental to the kid and all that stuff. But you don't have to know any of that if you just follow the NAP. So consequentially.
Proselytize.
Words.
Throwback.
Dude, I don't know what's with me today. I can't speak at all.
How do I into
consequentially? Consequentially, there we go. Consequentially, it is a useful tool that reduces the cost of making decisions as a human being. So there's good reasons to follow it. Does that make sense?
I wanted to mention X Logica in chat mentions that Neelsio would take great issue with Friedman being called the quintessential consequentialist.
Neelsio takes great issue with a great many of things.
Yeah, but I mean, in a way, he's right. I mean, there are a lot of consequentialist approaches. Like, I'm a consequentialist, sure, but I also came from more of the, what I would call, like, fringe element side, where I just have extreme mistrust of authority. That was good enough to get me where I am.
What would Dr. David Friedman and X Logica, if you want to respond in chat, by all means, what does he refer to himself as if Neelsio wouldn't like that label that we're kind of giving him?
David Friedman says, so tell me if I'm wrong, but I'm pretty darn sure that David Friedman refers to himself as not opposed to the moral arguments. Like, he still agrees with them, at least. He considers himself kind of a moral libertarian, but he thinks that the consequential arguments are more useful in converting people or, you know, explaining ideas to people. I think that's correct.
He's such like an extremely powerful-brained academic. Like, he's so, like, not attached to any idea. He'll just play back and forth with any of them back and forth, and he doesn't have people debate all the time, so he just debates himself to, like, get to better conclusions. The guy was insane. I was like, wow, you are real. I mean, throwing back to a few weeks ago when we spoke with him.
I do want to hit on what Neelsio. Am I pronouncing that right?
Yeah, Niels.
Niels. Okay, yeah. What he talks about. Niels,
which is his first name, and then you just add EO.
Niels EO. Okay.
There you go.
I'm really, see, my track record today is so bad that I've double checked like how to pronounce words like the or cat. So
yeah. It's a cat. The hat.
It's good to be sure.
Yeah, Niels makes the argument, which I think is what I would call the general argument for the libertarian ethic, which is to say that people have values and they should be as free as possible to pursue those values, or people have ends which reflect certain values, and people should be able to pursue those ends as freely as possible so long as they don't conflict with other people's pursuit of their ends. And when you do that, you end up with the free market, you end up with polycentric law, you end up with what we call anarcho-capitalism. And the non-aggression principle is merely a fallout out of letting people do that. It's not necessarily...
It's just emergently true.
Yeah, emergently true. That's correct. It's an emergent behavior of people simply letting people choose their own ends.
And yeah, you know, I remember at an SFL conference that Eternal, you and I were at, we saw Dan D'Amico SFL? Speak.
What's SFL?
Students for Liberty.
Very nice.
And Dan made a really similar argument to that. I guess he was sort of pushing the what he called like the Austro-Virginian sort of school of social science.
Yeah, political economy.
Described the NAP as something that's emergent rather than derived from principle, like I guess Hoppe does.
And just in the interest of keeping the user participation level up, because this is good. Toast, you said that you know you've had just an inherent mistrust of authority, which is I think is good. But the X is pointing out that he might refer to that as political nihilism, as it might equate to it, which you're free to disagree with.
I agree pretty much with that label. Like it's not a label I've heard before, so I can't group myself in with other beliefs of people that might also be described that way. But it seems to make sense.
I've used that before, because I think it's easy to say I'm a nihilist, and that to mean, like, Nietzschean nihilists don't believe anything actually exists, that kind of stuff, or existentialism similar to that, which is not where we stand. It's just, we only care about it in referring to political or moral philosophy. So moral cognitivist nihilist, or non-cognitivist, depending on where you stand, or sitting politically as a nihilist, I think that's a good way to put it.
Yeah.
Good discussion. We're getting close to the hour mark, guys.
We are getting close to the hour mark.
I said, to wrap up, the greater point is that, like, I guess 5 months ago or something, I was sort of at this, I was originally convinced to be an ANCAP sort of by moral arguments. And it was really my feelings of mistrust of authority, of course, that got me there. But the arguments to which I attached myself were moral arguments. And I found myself in this position where I looked at the meta ethics involved, strongly disagreed with the moral arguments I chose, how their meta ethics worked out. And I fell into this period where I would totally just downvote moral arguments because I thought they were so ineffective for whatever reason. I don't know why. And I think the moral of the story is that, as we've described, different arguments are going to have different effects on different people, and don't go off downvoting arguments just because they're not your choice of argument. I think it's really easy to get emotion involved in this, and it would serve the greater ANCAP community to not fall into that trap, I think.
I agree with that completely, and furthermore, I want to expand that definitely, if you're taking one thing out of this, don't be afraid to use arguments that didn't convince you, because they might convince the person you're talking to anyway. So be armed, be as well armed as possible. You know, always carry your extra gun and your ankle holster and your grenades in your back pocket just in case, and you know, be well armed.
Nice violent metaphors for voluntarism. I like it. No, but the point is valid. So it's about that time. It's about 2300 hours Eastern and 2000 Pacific. So keep Obama in president, you know. He gave us a phone. He's got a normative ethics. You too can choose to decline a state as we continue to feel all the feels on either declinefm.com or Decline a State on iTunes. I would like to remind you that Decline a State is brought to you free of charge, as well as paid advertisement free. We hope to soon have a Bitcoin donation link for those interested in helping keep the servers running, the website developing, and the show going. A big thanks to all of our hosts, tech experts, researchers, contributors, our listeners, and of course, the most brave listeners of all, Xlogica, thanks for joining us today. Decline Estate is an effort motivated by our love of liberty, as well as capitalist bow ties and free market monocles. Remember, when asked, always decline Estate. This is Ron McPaul saying, Romney, you suck.
This is Eternal. Hope you all enjoyed the discussion, guys. Take care.
This is Toast. Hope you didn't unenjoy my flu voice today. Hope that didn't go through too much.
Wrong opinion here. You should also check me out on the Geek and Gamer Guide podcast with Angel Clark.
Yeah, make sure to check out Wrong, everybody. He is making waves, making contacts. He's well received and liked, and I can understand why.
Well, thank you.
All right. Take care, everyone.
Wrong is the man that ANCAP needs, but not the one it deserves.
Yes. We'll be right back.